My understanding is that sometimes when you're working with people, you encourage them or walk them through a kind of meditation on their own death. Mm-hmm. Could you explain how that works?
Well, first, let me say that in order to put that into context, in my opinion, a lot of what the wisdom traditions have been teaching over the millennia are spiritual practices that allow us to let go of our habits of mind, of our roles that we find ourselves in, and those change throughout life, to let go of our preconceptions and even our perceptions themselves. And by allowing all of this to drop away, what we're left with is our true nature, which is luminous and divine and beautiful. And so, in a way, spiritual practice is walking the path of dying. And so, by using spiritual practices, but whether it's meditation individually or in groups, visualization practices, Qigong practices, which are energetic practices, prayer for a lot of people, we can use the immediacy of death, which gets people's attention right away. You know, as soon as you say, you tell someone a story about death and dying, they're listening. It brings the attention into a sharp focus because it's not just practice, you know. I mean, we're practicing for something, for the show, right, for the real deal. And so if we want to sort of emulate a death experience, we can use spiritual practices which enable us to drop all of these impediments to our true nature. And that allows us then to be with dying, to be with our own dying or with other people's dying.
Could you give me an example of how you would, of what that would look like in a context, in a workshop context?
Yeah, well, in the workshop or in the retreat context, we take many approaches. So we approach this physically through body movement, Qigong, basically. Some people use yoga to harmonize the mind and the body. We approach it intellectually through giving information and resources. We approach it emotionally by listening to people tell their stories, by being heard, opens the heart in a profound way. And then we approach it spiritually. So we don't just dive into the deepest water right away. We're approaching this from many different ways. And over the course of a number of hours or a number of class meetings, we begin to slowly step into a way to be with, essentially with not knowing, which is a profound state of openness. And, you know, for some people, that has to go through grief. We get people who are in deep grief or people who are in repressed grief. And so grief is actually, in my opinion, is a form of love. We don't have grief without love. If we love someone and the person dies, grief arises naturally. And it only arises because the love was there. So it's actually a form of love, and it's not something that we want to get rid of, although we may try because we have to go to work next Monday, right? And we can't work if we're crying all the, you know, so that it is difficult, you know, to really do that. And so people come in and we'll offer an opportunity for people to really step into that and accept that grief and share it with other people. And so the physical, the intellectual, the emotional, these are openings that allow for then an experience of spiritual really knowing. And the only way to really know is by opening all these other, you know, avenues, these other doorways. We can't have a spiritual experience if our heart is still closed because we haven't dealt with the grief.
You said really knowing, and I'm thinking really, it's also really not knowing and having that be okay.
Of course.
Right. I once had a yoga teacher who in Shavasana, in the resting period at the end of the yoga class, offered a visualization to us that is pretty untraditional in the westernized yoga tradition, which is that after all the kind of relaxing the face, relaxing the feet, relaxing the hands, so on and so forth, he said, now imagine that you are 6 feet underground and the soil is pressing you into the soil underneath you and there is nothing to do. There is no action necessary. And for me, it was a beautiful moment of release of any intention or agency. And every so often, very rarely, I suffer from insomnia and I remember that again. I do that again. I imagine being 6 feet under, being buried underground and just being kind of contained. And it's fascinating to me because when I mention it to other people, generally they find the notion appalling, that they have an anxiety reaction as opposed to a kind of release and relief reaction. I wonder what kind of responses you get when you ask people to confront the notion, the true notion of mortality, their mortality.
Yeah, well, this is why I didn't answer your last question directly, because, you know, we have to prepare. And there are really stages of preparing for death, whether we have a terminal diagnosis or whether we're 21 years old. Preparing for death is very useful, not only in practical sense that we're going to die and we don't know when, but let me tell you a story about this. So when I lived out in the country, I was a volunteer EMT. And we had all kinds of situations, as you can imagine. And one call we went to was for a gentleman in his late 80s who had suffered a heart attack. And by the time we got to the scene, it was in a house, he was lying on the floor and he was dead. There was just no question about it. There was no treatment, nothing we could do. So we called the coroner, you know, and we waited. And this is in a very rural area, and it took a long time, probably 45 minutes, for the officials to arrive. And many of the EMTs, you know, knew the family because we were local people and so on. And it was a sad scene. You know, a lot of the family was there. It was very sad. And this man was clearly not there. The body was stiff. It was getting cold, all of these things. It was pale. And so eventually they took the body away and we dispersed and I went home. And I always do a meditation after any kind of a call just to sort of release it. And this was night and I did that and suddenly I had this unbelievable experience of incredible joy. And everything was luminous. You know, the chair, the light, you know, the dog, you know, my wife, everything was just luminous. And I said, what is going on here? And the answer came to me right away. I'm not dead. That man was dead. And I'm alive. And it brought this amazing immediacy and intensity to my experience, which is possible, you know, to bring in more and more and more and to really enliven, you know, our life. So that's a reason for these kind of practices, aside from our own preparation and aside from being able to be present for others, which is huge. It brings, life becomes sweeter. I do these practices now frequently, every day, called taking in the good. And I just, if I see a Japanese maple tree that's glowing with its red leaves in the sun in the autumn, I'll just stop and look and breathe 7 times and just take that in. And the more we're able to do this, the more fully alive we can be. And that's the real reason for doing these death practices. People have to get past the initial aversion to the whole subject, which is a cultural aversion. We think it's individual. Oh, that's icky. I don't like that. We think this is my individual reaction to this. And it is. But it comes from the culture.
Is it partially that we have hived death off from life when, in fact, they're intimately, fundamentally connected?
Yeah. You know, and people talk about 100 years ago, the life expectancy was 46. And you had a 50% chance of reaching the age of 12 when you were born. And families were large. And this was one of the reasons. And families were extended. And communities were close. And so death was just almost a normal occurrence. You still see this in the Amish community. I have Amish friends. And they go to funerals all the time because it just happens that way. And so we've lost touch with that. You know, we don't need the family there because we have insurance. You know, we don't need each other. We're all of these individuals. And at the same time, because of the medical advances, death now looks a lot different for us here in America, in the West. Death 100, 150 years ago was sudden, traumatic, irreversible, and pretty fast. Generally. Nowadays, we might have 3 months or 6 months or 2 years or 4 years. And so this is a two-edged sword. It's a great opportunity, if we want to embrace it, to step into that for growth and connection. And at the same time, with all the medical interventions, we have the capacity to prolong life in ways that may not be so fruitful for a lot of people.
It sounds like what you're saying is that by being mindful of our mortality, essentially, it creates a possibility for us to be more conscious in our living. And you're also a proponent of conscious dying. I wonder if you could explain just a bit what that is.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's the Woody Allen quote.
I don't know it.
I don't mind dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens. And, you know, I think that's a lot of people agree with that. And certainly many of us die under heavy sedation or having suffered from Alzheimer's or dementia or some kind of a mental comatose-inducing sort of situation. You know, I think the conscious aspect can come in terms of planning. So we can plan at many different levels. You know, we can plan at practical levels. And, you know, we're fairly good at that, you know, writing wills and getting our affairs in order.
Advanced medical directives.
Yeah. All of those things. Mm-hmm. Very important. Very, very useful. We can take a little step deeper. And we can plan at a relational level. So who am I at odds with in my life? Who do I need to forgive in my life? Who needs to forgive me? Who would I give my blessings to? My grandchildren, maybe? Who haven't I seen in a long time who I really would just like to connect with one more time? These kinds of questions are about getting our emotional affairs in order. And it's very important in the dying process, if we have time to do that. There's a lot of suffering when people don't do these things, particularly if there's a death that's sudden and or traumatic, and people didn't have a chance to say what they wanted to say or resolve whatever the issue was. So that's part of conscious dying.
You shared with me an advanced directive for conscious dying, mm-hmm. which I filled out.
Good for you.
It was really interesting to do it. You know, you have questions here about who do you want to be with you most and who do you not want there? Mm-hmm. Some of those answers for me were really surprising. Mm-hmm. What are some of the responses that you get to this process of figuring out, if we are given the luxury of time, how we would like to use those final weeks?
Yeah. And just the exercise of imagining a scenario where we are dying brings a brighter light, and it sets things up in stark contrast. So I really don't want that person there. I never really thought about it, but now that I think about it, I really want to see these people. I really want all of these kinds of issues that are brought up in the Advanced Directive for Conscious Dying suddenly become real. And so the exercise of filling these out and thinking about these things may be a fantasy, because your death may not occur that way at all, and we have very little control over that usually. But it may be extremely useful for how you're going to live 5 minutes from now, 5 minutes after you fill out this form. Well, now maybe I will give that person a call, or what about?
Maybe I will issue that apology. Maybe I will make sure they know I love them now.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the thing is, we don't have to forgive everybody. You know, it really is not a requirement. And so it may be that there are some people who have just been so difficult in our lives that it would be destructive for us to have them present. And our inner circle, whoever our close people are, you know, if we are unable to get up out of bed and do things we need to do and so on, and if we're dying, that inner circle can be informed. Well, I really want to see this person, and this person not so much, you know, or this person not at all. And just to envision that, how you may choose to deal with that the next year or 10 years after that is up to you. But using death as a way to cast these issues in a bright light is very, very useful.
So you have an entire section about who you want around, and it's very interesting, and who you want to reach out to in different kinds of ways, whether you want to be alone for part of the time or all of the time. Mm-hmm. And then you also have a whole section about the setting, and I talked with one of my colleagues about it. And for him, the scene setting was actually the really critical thing. Mm-hmm. Why, of course, we think about, I mean, I've been at a couple of deathbeds, and there are ways to make it more or less pleasant for everybody involved. Mm-hmm. But it seems like you're taking a more considered approach to the setting.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's right. And that's partly to help in the visualization, but it's also practical and real. And I do want to say that the responses people write to the Advanced Directive will change over time. And so it's very useful to update it, review it, just look it over every so often to see how those changes happen. But music, for instance, music has been shown and demonstrated time and time again to be extremely valuable near end of life for everyone involved. Music seems to have a way of just penetrating the heart right away. And if it's music that's shared, you and your loved one, this is your favorite song or piece can be tremendously transformative at end of life. And there are many stories of people actually taking their last breath when a certain piece of music is played. That was actually what happened with my mother.
Hmm.
When she was a young girl, she learned piano and she had a Chopin piece that she played. And she died a number of years ago. We had an album with that. It was actually a tape on a loop being played again and again. And when that piece came up, that's when she breathed out her last breath. And in a way that carried her, the pleasant memories and the beauty and just the flow of that music carried her.
When you use the term conscious dying, I'm assuming that means being present, if, again, we are so lucky as to be present.
Mm.
In what ways does the setting, you know, what you're wearing, what's in the room, is it about making it a more pleasant place to be? Well,
yeah, you know, if we think about, for instance, what photographs we want to have around us, what images, maybe your ancestors, maybe a spiritual teacher, maybe an image of a religious figure, very important. You know, what you're literally bringing those into that sacred space. It really is about transforming either a day-to-day home setting or more often an institutional setting, whether it's a nursing home or a hospice or a hospital, into a sacred space. And there really is a point at which it changes. And we're no longer trying to prolong life. We're now creating the stage setting for the final act, you know. And people can bring flowers and people can bring something maybe that has a certain smell that reminds people of things. And as a person's dying, very often, if they're unresponsive, they can still hear. And so music or storytelling can be very important. They can often still feel, sense, touch. And so doing some kind of touch, either if it's a formal sort of massage touch or a Reiki or just loving touch in some way, this can have a profound effect on the person's passage. One of the reasons that this can be difficult for people is that they may feel alone and frightened. And when we're alone and frightened, the touch of someone we love can transform everything, just a simple touch, or a voice, no matter what they're talking about, just the awareness of the voice. And so the physical setting has a profound effect on that. You know, how do we feel when we walk into a bank compared to how we feel when we walk into a cathedral? You know, it's a different thing.
Hmm. Filling this out was really interesting for me, and thank you for sharing it. And one of the things that was most surprising to me and really made me pause is one question that you have, and you ask, how strictly do you want your wishes to be adhered to? By your loved ones? Do you want them to do exactly as you say, even if they may be uncomfortable? Do you want your loved ones to do what brings them the most peace? And I wondered how much about this conscious dying movement is about claiming ownership of our deaths, mm-hmm. in a way,
mm-hmm.
and or sharing it. Who do we want to share it with and how?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we don't want to encourage clinging to a certain scenario either. And that's why that question is in there. You know, here's how I see it all unfolding, and I'm ready to let go of it. You know, to not attach to a certain story about how this is going to be. And that's really why that's there. There was a woman who declared that she's a deep Buddhist practitioner, dying of cancer, and just made it very clear to everyone that she did not want any kind of mind-altering drug She didn't want morphine or anything like that, no matter what. And it puts those around her into an ethical dilemma at a certain point.
Because she's visibly suffering.
Visibly suffering. And it reaches a point where someone has to say, we need to override this. And so giving permission for that as an example, I think is very important. Mm-hmm. You know, and this depends on us having trusted people who we're close to, who we anticipate will be with us. And many of us don't have that. So we can envision a certain thing, and who will be there to implement it? One of the populations that I'm most interested in are the people who are alone. The homeless people who die, people who are perhaps very aged and they really don't have anyone. We don't want to die alone. Humans have tried not to die alone, I think, for as long as we've been around. We've wanted this to be an event that's shared. And if we think about, we can think about our own death, and that's useful. And we can think about other people in our lives who've died and what impact that's had on us. And if we look at that, at how profound that's been, that my grandmother or my father or whoever it was, what impact that had on my life, and then turn it around and say, what impact will my death, and more importantly than my death, how I die, what impact will that have on other people?
It's our final act in a way.
Indeed. Hmm. And can be our final gift.
What have you seen in terms of the most common challenges that come up for people to die as peacefully as possible?
Well, I'll tell you another story. There was a man who's 84 years old, who was dying of a brain cancer, actually. And he had never, over the course of his diagnosis and illness, which had been several months, had never acknowledged that he was dying. Not to his wife, not to anybody. Never even would discuss it, even in practical terms about his will and so on. I was sitting with him, and for some reason, sometimes a person will project onto someone else who they don't know. They'll project certain qualities. And this is one of the advantages to having a compassionate stranger at a bedside. There's no baggage. And so whatever that person sees you as, that's who you are to them. So there's a process of sort of discernment. Well, who am I with this person? And this man never took his eyes off me and really could hardly speak. It turns out he died one day later. I felt that it was important that he, in some way, come to grips with the fact that he was truly dying. There was classical music playing in the room. And I said to him, isn't that beautiful? And he nodded. And I said, you know, the person who wrote that symphony died a long time ago. But the symphony keeps on going. And we can still hear it. Now, this man was, although he was very wealthy and was a developer and had done very well, he had encouraged a lot of younger people. He had a book that people had come and signed thanking him for all that he had done for them. And so when I mentioned that about the music, I said to him, all that you've done continues beyond the end of the body. And tears came to his eyes, and he nodded. That was his first acknowledgement that he was dying. And like I said, he died the next day. And so there's a way, if we pay attention often, that people can touch into something that's very profound when their attention is riveted at the end of life. So I'll tell you one other one that's a little different. This was another gentleman who was also in his, he was in his late 80s. He was a farmer, been a farmer his whole life, dairy farmer. And he had three strikes against him. He had brain cancer, very advanced. He had Alzheimer's, very advanced. And he was comatose. He was
not an ideal setting for a conscious death,
maybe. To say the least. And so he had been laying in the bed without eating, drinking, or moving, or speaking for several days. And I sat with him for probably 45 minutes and began just sort of talking about dairy cows and haying and sort of familiar things until I felt like there was some kind of connection. He could move a little bit, slightly. And at a certain point, it just intuitively came to me, and I just said to him, you know, death is really just a natural thing, isn't it? He sat bolt upright in bed, extended his arms and hands as far as he could in front of him, looked up with his eyes wide open, and held the position as long as he could, probably 30 seconds, until his muscles gave out. And then he relaxed back down into the bed. There are just ways that people can do these things. And so I don't know, you know, what a person, what people's impediments are at the end of life. A common one, I guess, it has to do with pain medication, you know, and if what level of pain medication do we want in terms of conscious dying, you know, that can be an impediment. Sometimes pain medications are given for the benefit of the bystanders of the family because they're uncomfortable. And so looking very carefully at what we're giving this person, that can help, you know, with any kind of an impediment. Impediments can be emotional and often are. We want this person at the bedside. There's so many stories in the literature of someone who's distant geographically and emotionally calling and putting the phone to the patient's ear and, you know, tears and grief and, you know, just a release. There can be many different ways. A lot of times we're afraid of leaving people who we don't know if they're going to be okay without us, you know. And so we talk about the five things that we want said at the end of life. So first one's I love you. Second one is I forgive you. Third one is please forgive me. Fourth one is thank you. Thank you for your life. And the fifth one is, it's okay. It's okay to die. I'll be okay if you die. They'll be okay if you die. You'll be okay if you die. All those things. So the impediments can arise at any one of those levels, and probably just in terms of fear as well.
So in this directive for conscious dying, one of the things that I kept wondering was, well, I felt a sense of ownership over my death that I had never felt before, my theoretical death. Mm-hmm. But then I started to wonder how much it is actually for other people, like making space for other people to have their experience of my death as well.
It's so true. And, you know, you were talking about asking about impediments and, you know, what my death is going to be like for the other people in my life is a profound thing to meditate upon, to try to see. And one of the techniques, you know, when we have fears that we're living with that come up for us, is to, we have to be careful not to get lost in them. If they're very huge, we don't want to get lost in them. But if we can manage them, to begin to take some steps into them and really look at what that might be like. That's what this is about. Well, what's a big fear? I'm going to die. How can I begin to step into that? Well, let's kind of look at it a little piece at a time. You know, and that's what we're doing here. Another exercise we ask people to do in some of our classes is to write their own obituary. And when I first did this, I said, okay, yeah, I'm going to do this. You know, I'll do it tomorrow. You know, and weeks went by before I actually said, okay, I'm going to do this, and finally did it. And once I got into doing it, it was very entertaining. It just became this kind of light thing. But at the same time, very useful. Because I said to Susan, you know, my wife, I said, this is in a file, here it is. You know? And you know, if I die suddenly, people are gonna be traumatized. This is not just my death. You know, this is impacting everyone. And if people are traumatized and they're expected to write obituaries and make decisions about green burial and funeral and what am I going to do, and then make all these decisions under this kind of duress, very, very difficult.
There's something you just said that really struck a chord with me, and that is, this is not just my death.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's part of the thing that we have to, or we are able to encounter if we choose to fill out the advance directive for conscious dying or to plan more carefully, like consider that tension of what do I need, what do the people around me need, where is the balance point of those things.
Yeah, and share this with other people, because this is a wonderful exercise to do individually for your own, you know, awareness, and then share it with someone. It may be the first time they've ever thought of you dying, whether it's a parent or a sibling or a partner or a child, whoever it may be. And suddenly it's like, oh my God, you know. And whenever there's a death, it's just like ringing a huge bell and all these other bells vibrate a little bit. Whenever we're in the presence of death, we're in the presence of our own mortality as well. So we don't do any of these things in isolation. This is sort of the point, is that if we can look at this not as, oh my God, how am I going to do this? If we look at this as, okay, we're going to do this together. And I think as a society, we're beginning to take some steps into, how are we going to do this? How do we do this? How did our ancestors do this? You know, people had ways of doing this that we in some ways can rediscover and reinvent. It's incredible to me, you know, in talking to ministers, ask them what training they've had in death and dying, in all their ministerial training. Usually none. You know, this has got to come into our lives individually and collectively, if we're going to do this with some kind of awareness and some kind of benefit. So important, even from the point of view of money, of our healthcare dollars, that we're spending huge amounts of money. I had a client, who received a hip transplant 6 months before he died. Of what value are these incredible procedures if we're so afraid that we're going to prolong life at any cost, literally? We're impacting everyone. The people who need health, children, mothers who are pregnant, who are poor. Where are we putting our dollars? And I really feel that our emotional and spiritual views of death and dying play directly into the whole society, even just if you're looking at the medical system and the money that's being spent. So none of this happens in isolation. It all affects everyone else. And we're not trained to think that way in this culture. But our ancestors did.
In the end, we cannot die alone.
We cannot die alone. We cannot die alone.